Hello, boys and girls. This is your friend, the old gray goose, with some very scary stories just for Halloween. Originally, Halloween was known as All Hallows Eve and was celebrated at the end of the harvest when the skies grew cold and the leaves shriveled up and blew off the trees. Somewhere along the line, it became popular for people to tell stories of witches, ghosts, and goblins to each other just for fun, and for kids to dress up in frightening costumes and go trick-or-treating door-to-door just like we do today. So cuddle up with a friend, draw the covers close, and get ready to be scared, but not too scared, because I'll be with you every step of the way, just you and me. I used to travel from New York City to London. I was always afraid to go by airplane. Air flight always made me sick. So I would always travel by boat. Ah, yes. The many boat rides I took. I can remember all of them now. And I met many people on these boat rides. Every once in a while, I would meet a friend. And I can remember one especially whose name was Cowley. He and I both suffered from the same thing, insomnia. We couldn't sleep at night. And so we would while away the time playing billiards in the ship's billiard room. And it was on such a night as this that something happened. All of a sudden, the ship gave a start. I don't know what happened. Maybe it had hit a mine unreclaimed from the Second World War. The ship jiggled. Cowley was worried. He had fallen on the floor, and he picked himself up and sat himself in a chair on one side of the room, and I sat on the other side. "Do you think they'll send people to rescue us?" he said. I don't know. They probably will. "But when? When will it be?" "I don't know. I don't know." The lights flickered and grew dim again, and this time the lights went out. Now we were in complete darkness. But here in this room, we had a pocket of trapped air. How long it would last, I don't know. A day, a week, a month? That is asking too much. "When will they come?" asked Cowley again. I don't know when they'll come. "Will they come?" "I don't know that either. But they probably will. They'll be here soon. How does anyone know that the ship even had an accident?" "They'll know. They'll know. Rescuers will come. Don't worry." Oh, I could put up with anything. Anything at all, if it wasn't for this pain in my stomach. I knew from that moment on I had to stay awake. I couldn't see Cowley because it was dark, but I knew that I had to stay awake to make sure that nothing happened. And from time to time he would oh, yes. He would laugh and mumble to himself. And sometimes he might say something. He would say something like, "I know what happens to people in our situation. I'm not quite sure I understand what you mean." You don't understand what I mean. Of course you do. People who are captured like us, with no food, after a while, get hungry. And where do you think they get that food? I'm not quite sure what you mean. Oh. Yes, you are. You know what I mean. People who are caught in a situation like us begin to eat each other. What? You're crazy, coward. Please don't say that again. If it wasn't for this pain in my stomach, I could endure anything. I knew that I had to stay awake. I had to make sure that I did not fall asleep, because I felt that if I fell asleep, Cowley might attack me. So I listened for his heavy breathing. And then daylight came, and we could see a shaft of light come down through one of the windows. So we hadn't fallen that far. Maybe we were on a shelf, not too far from the surface. "Do you think they'll come today?" said Cowley. When it was light out, he seemed to be more happy. I said, "I don't know." But as time went on, as the day went on, and no rescuers came, Cowley began to get sullen again and moody. Oh, this pain in my stomach. And it became dark again. I sat in my chair, and I could hear the heavy breathing of Cowley across the room. I didn't know whether he was sleeping or not. Every once in a while, he would laugh or mumble once again. So for the second night, I stayed awake. And then it became dawn again. Once again, Cowley began to ask more questions about rescuers and when they would come. "If they haven't come by now," he said, "they're not going to come at all. There's not going to be any rescuers. The only people we can depend on are ourselves." It became night again, and I tried to stay awake. I tried to keep my eyelids open. I tried as I could. I started to fall asleep. I woke myself up a couple of times, but then I must have really fallen off. I woke up and Cowley's hands were around my neck. I couldn't breathe. I couldn't breathe. And I reached out with my hand. I tried to push him away. Away. Oh, I couldn't take it. I couldn't breathe. And I felt my finger go into his eye. And I felt the warm jelly of his eye on my finger. And I put it in my mouth and ate it. And I pushed him away. He fell down. I stepped up. I reached out and I could feel the billiard table. I felt one of the cues. I grabbed one of the cues and I held it out, and as Cowley came toward me, I stuck the billiard cue right down his mouth. And he fell over. The billiard cue hit the floor. And it went through the back of his head and cracked. He made sort of a gurgling sound as he went down. That was 3 days ago. I could take anything if it wasn't for this pain in my stomach. Cowley's all gone now. And I'm hungry again. This story took place in Upper New York State. Once there was a college there. It was a medical college. Sometimes they would take bodies of people who had died in New York City. And they would take them to this medical college. Or maybe someone had willed their body to science. This story that I'm going to tell you took place a number of years ago. And because of what happened, the medical school had to close. And now ivy crawls the walls. No one is there. You know how it is in many colleges. Sometimes they have their students do different things. I remember when I was in college, my freshman year, I had to wear a little beanie. And we could never be caught without that beanie. And we had a rope pull across a lake, a small pond or a lake. And if we pulled the sophomores across the pond, we could take our beanies off. But if they pulled us across, we had to wear our beanies for the rest of the year. And sometimes you've heard of other things too, things even worse, where maybe someone has been taken out into the country and maybe their clothes taken off or something else, and they've been told to go back on their own. Well, in this college, they did such things to the freshmen. In this particular group of freshmen, there was one who stood out. He was a nervous, twitchy, know-it-all freshman. The seniors didn't like him because he knew more than they did. He was like what we would call today a nerd. So they wanted to have their best for him. Here is what they had planned. On campus, they had three buildings. They had the classroom buildings where all of the students attended classes. They had the dormitory buildings where the students slept at night and stayed during the day. And then they had the laboratory buildings. Now, in the laboratory building, on one of them, on the second floor, if you went down the end of the corridor and opened the door, inside were caskets. It was what was called a morgue. And here is where these bodies would end up, of helpless individuals who had died. Here is what they had planned for the nervous, know-it-all, twitchy freshman. They were going to have him report outside the laboratory building at 12 midnight. They were going to ask him if he had a weapon or had a flashlight. And then they were going to have him go into the laboratory building, up to the second floor, down the end of the corridor, and into the morgue, and go over to casket number 13, and open up casket number 13. That was all. What they didn't tell him, that was inside casket number 13, they were going to place one of their burly football players. And when this nervous know-it-all freshman opened up casket number 13, out would jump this big football player. And he would scare this know-it-all. And he would scream and yell and cry and come running down the steps and out the laboratory building, and everybody would have a good laugh. Or so they thought. The night came when this all was to happen. It was midnight, and it so happened that there was no moon that night. It was a dark and cold night, and they had made sure that they had shut off all the electricity in all of the buildings so that there was no light shining anywhere. They told the nervous, know-it-all, twitchy freshman what he had to do. And they asked him if he had a flashlight or had a knife. And he said no. And then he went into the building. He went up to the second floor. Or so they thought. They watched and waited outside. Fifteen minutes went by. They heard nothing. A half an hour went by, and still there were no sounds. But they thought, if I was in his position, I would be taking my time. Plus it's dark. He would have to feel his way along. After 45 minutes went by, some began to worry. Well, let's wait 15 more minutes. If we don't hear anything in 15 more minutes, then we'll do something. 15 minutes went by, and still nothing. No sound, nothing. So they sent one person back to get flashlights. They sent another person back to turn on all the electricity in the buildings. But it was going to take time. The group started into the laboratory building, and they started up the stairs, and all the big guys were pushing all the little guys up front. And they got to the top of the stairs, and they stopped, and they listened. They didn't hear anything. Then slowly, as a group, they began to go down the corridor toward the morgue. When they reached the door to the morgue, the first person there felt that it was open. He had at least come this far. Maybe even now he was inside. So once again, they stopped and listened. But they heard nothing. Then one by one, they began going into the morgue. And they had to hold their hands out in front of them to make sure that they didn't bump into anything. One person was holding out his hand. And as his hand was held out, he felt something drop on the back of it. Something wet. Just at this time, the person who had gone back for the flashlights came, and all he could find was a little pocket flashlight. And he shone the light on the back of the person's hand. There on the back of his hand was a drop of blood. Just at this time, all of the lights went on in the building. And they looked around, and they looked up. Up, and there in the rafters was an arm, just an arm, dripping red blood. They looked all around the rest of the morgue, and they saw all parts of a body, all thrown about. They went over to casket number 13. They opened up casket number 13, and there inside was this nervous, know-it-all, twitchy freshman with a knife in his hand. They had to call the police. The police came up with this. They said that probably when they asked him if he had a knife or a flashlight, he said no, but He really did have a knife. It was just a pocket knife, but it was a knife for protection because he was nervous and all. And when he went up into the morgue and opened up casket number 13, and this big, burly football player jumped out at him, he lost all his senses. And he didn't know what he was doing, and he took this knife and he slashed this football player to ribbons. And then he took the parts of the body and threw them around the room, still not aware of what he was doing. But then he came to his senses and he realized what he had done. And he knew that he had to pay for what he had done. So he went over to casket number 13, put the knife blade over his hat, and let the lid close, pushing the knife down into his hat. Thus he paid for what he had done. Since that time, the school has been closed. And this is the story of the Bloody Iron. One time I went to a school and they were having a Halloween party. And they were singing Halloween songs. And all of their Halloween songs were to the tune of Christmas songs. And I had never heard a Halloween song before, but I went back home and I started to make up some of my own Halloween songs. And here is one of the ones I made up. Oscar the light-headed pumpkin had a very shiny nose and mouth and eyes, and if you ever saw him, you would even say he glows. All of the other pumpkins used to laugh and call him names. Look at old empty head trying to burn the candle at both ends. They never let poor Oscar join in any pumpkin games. Let's go down the corner and get smashed, but don't tell Oscar. Then one foggy All Hallows Eve, the great pumpkin came to say, Oscar, with your nose so bright, and your mouth and your eyes, won't you watch my pumpkin patch tonight? Well, then now the pumpkins loved him, as they shouted out, Ouchie! Oscar, the light-headed pumpkin, you're as bright as anyone can be. One time I was walking with my grandnephew, and oh, what a grandnephew he is. We were walking in Massachusetts, and Massachusetts has a lot of antiquitous gravestones. Not only that, they're old too. And we went to this graveyard, and we looked at some of the gravestones there, and some of them went back to the 1700s. And here are some of the words on the gravestones that I can remember. Here lies one Mr. Wood, enclosed in wood, one wood within another. The outer wood is very good. We cannot praise the other. God takes the good people, too good on earth to stay. God leaves the bad, too bad to take away. Here was one, it was an epitaph for a dentist. View this gravestone with gravity. He is filling his last cavity. I can remember one that said, died at 30, buried at 60. Sacred to the memory of Mr. Jared Bates, who died August the 6th, 1800. His widow, aged 24, who mourns as one who can be comforted, lived at 7 Elm Street, this village, and possesses every qualification for a good wife. Here lies the body of Obadiah Wilkinson and Ruth, his wife. Their warfare accomplished. Here lies Bernard Lightfoot, who was accidentally killed in the 45th year of his age, erected by his grateful family. Here's a testimonial that marks this man's grave. Here lies a man who did no good, and if he'd lived, he never would. When he's gone or how he fares, nobody knows and nobody cares. There was one that I saw about a locksmith. A zealous locksmith died of late and did not enter heaven's gate, but stood without and would not knock, because he meant to pick the lock. Molly, though pleasant in her day, was suddenly seized and sent away. How soon she's ripe, how soon she's rotten, laid in the grave and soon forgotten. Here was an epitaph to an unhappy marriage. Within this grave do lie, back to back, my wife and I. When the last trump the air shall fill, if she gets up, I'll just lie still. Sacred to the memory of Anthony Drake, who died for peace and quietness' sake. His wife was constantly scolding and scoffing, so he sought repose in a $12 coffin. Poor Martha Shield has gone away. Her would if she could, but her couldn't stay. Her had two bad legs and a baddish cough. It was her two bad legs that carried her off. Here lies Jan Smith, wife of Thomas Smith, marble cutter. This monument was erected by her husband as a tribute to her memory and a specimen of his work. Monuments of the same style, $350. Here is what it says on Benjamin Franklin's tombstone. The body of Benjamin Franklin, printer, like the covering of an old book, its contents torn out and stripped of its lettering and gilding, lies here, food for worms. But the work shall not be lost. It will, as he believed, appear once more in a new and more beautiful edition, corrected and amended by the author. Once there was a young boy who was hiking out in the country. As he was hiking along, it began to rain. It also began to thunder and lightning. And he was a little scared and a little wet. And he saw off in the distance a house up on the top of a hill. He decided he would try to go to the house and get out of the rain. And so he ran up the hill to where the house was. As he was on the porch, he noticed that it didn't seem like the house was lived in. But he thought that he should knock on the door. As he knocked on the door squeaked open. And he went in, inside. On the inside, he saw only cobwebs. And he had to be careful that he didn't get some in his face as he walked around the house. But then he heard, coming toward him, footsteps. But he couldn't see anything. And the footsteps kept coming closer and closer. And so he began to walk fast at first and then to run. And he ran up a flight of stairs to the second floor. And the footsteps followed him. and he ran down a corridor. And the footsteps followed him still. He went into a room, and he closed the door, and went over to the other side of the room. And the footsteps came right through the door, without the door even opening. He felt a doorknob up against his back. And he opened the door, and there inside was an elevator. And he went inside the elevator and pressed one of the buttons. And down, down went the elevator. It came out into a room. And inside this room were a whole bunch of coffins. And over at one edge, there was a long chute. And all of a sudden, up at the top of the chute, a door opened. And a coffin started coming out of the chute. And the boy was right near the bottom of the chute. And this coffin started rolling down the chute toward the boy. And at the same time, once again, he heard the footsteps coming closer and closer toward him. He couldn't go forward, and he couldn't go backward. So he took out a cough drop, and the coffin stopped. ...1958... North Carolina. Last month, David Holt passed away. His wife was left with almost no money and a 4-year-old son to support. About 2 weeks ago, a strange thing happened. Young Bobby Holt picked up a pencil and pad and began to write. After filling 3 sheets, he gave the message to his mother. Mrs. Holt couldn't believe what she saw. The message was in shorthand. Young Bobby couldn't read or write, let alone use shorthand. Not knowing shorthand herself, Mrs. Holt took the sheets to an expert. When the message was read, Mrs. Holt almost fainted. It was from her husband. It told how much he loved his wife and son. It also said they should go to a bank in New York. At the bank, Mrs. Holt found that her husband had rented a safety deposit box. In it was an insurance policy worth thousands of dollars. Never again would the young widow have to worry about money. Scientists have no explanation for the strange story. Did young Bobby somehow receive a message from the grave? If not, how could he suddenly start writing shorthand? How and why was he able to locate the insurance money? Money that only a dead man knew about. Once there was a high school girl who was coming from a basketball game. She got into her car in the school parking lot. As she pulled out of the parking lot, a red pickup truck pulled in right behind her. After about a mile, she noticed that the truck was still there. And then the truck turned on its high beams so that the light shone into her car. And he kept them on for about a minute and then turned them off. When she passed a car, the truck went with her. When she went fast, the truck went fast. When she slowed down, he slowed down. And then every once in a while, on would come the high beams for about a minute and then go off. What was going on? She was beginning to get scared. She
She pulled off on a side road, a sort of shortcut that she often took. Nobody ever took that road. But the red pickup truck followed her on the road. And she slowed down so that she was hardly going very fast at all. Maybe he just wanted to pass her. But no. When she slowed down, he slowed down and once again turned on his high beams. Finally, she reached the end of the road. And she turned into her driveway and got out of the car and ran into the house and told her father, "Call the police, call the police." They looked out the window and they saw a man get out of the red pickup truck. And he had a gun in his hand. When the police came, he said, "You don't want to arrest me. It's him you want to arrest." And he pointed toward the girl's car. They opened the back door. And there in the back seat was a man crouched down with a knife in his hand. The driver of the pickup truck said, "I noticed her when she pulled out of the parking lot, that he had crawled into the back." Every once in a while, he would begin to rise up with his knife as if he was to attack her. Then I would put my high beams on. When I put my high beams on, he would go down behind the seat again. And every time he came up, I would put my high beams on. She was running from the wrong person. The person that was trying to save her, she was running from. "Oh, Dunderbeck, oh, Dunderbeck, how could you be so mean? To ever have invented the sausage meat machine for all the rats and pussycats who never more be seen. They're all ground up to sausage meat in Dunderbeck's machine." One dark, rainy Sunday afternoon, a fat and jolly butcher named Donald Dunderbeck had an argument over money with his wife, Shirley. Dunderbeck lost his temper and killed Shirley. Then he ground her up into sausage meat and buried her bones under a flat rock in the backyard. To keep the murder a secret, he told everyone that she had moved away. Dunderbeck mixed his new sausage meat with pork, then seasoned it with salt and pepper, added some sage and thyme and a bit of garlic. To give it a special flavor, he smoked it in his smokehouse for a while. He called it Dunderbeck's Special Sausage. There was such a demand for this new sausage that Dunderbeck bought the best hogs he could find and started raising his own pork. He also kept a sharp lookout for humans who might make a tasty sausage meat. One day, a nice, plump school teacher came into his shop. Dunderbeck grabbed her and ground her up. Another time, Dunderbeck's dentist came by. He was a little round man. Into the grinder he went. And one by one, the children in the neighborhood began to disappear. And so did their kittens and puppies. No one ever dreamed that Dunderbeck the butcher had anything to do with it. Things went on that way for years. Then, one day, Dunderbeck made a big mistake. A fat boy came into the butcher shop. Dunderbeck grabbed him and started to drag him off to the sausage grinder. But the boy broke loose and ran out of the shop. And Dunderbeck chased after him, waving a big butcher knife. When people saw this, they realized at once what had become of all the missing children and grown-ups and kittens and puppies. An angry crowd gathered at the butcher shop. No one knows for sure just what happened to Dunderbeck that day. Some say he was fed to his hogs. Others say he was fed to his sausage grinder. But he was never seen again. And neither was his wonderful sausage meat. One day I went a-walkin' to the store. I bought a pound of sausage meat and placed it on the floor. I whistled and I whistled and I whistled up the tune. And all of the sausage meat went dancing round the room. Oh, Dunderbeck, how could you be so mean? Ever have invented the sausage meat machine? For all the rats and pussycats who'll never more be seen. They're all ground up to sausage meat in Dunderbeck's machine. One day the damn thing busted, the damn thing wouldn't go. So Dunderbeck, he climbed inside, the reason for to know. His wife was having nightmares and walking in her sleep. She gave the crank a heck of a yank, and Dunderbeck was beat. Oh, Dunderbeck, how could you be so mean? Ever have invented the sausage meat machine? For all the rats and pussycats who'll never more be seen. They're all ground up to sausage meat in Dunderbeck's machine. Hey! Emily had just fallen asleep when she heard a strange voice. Emily, it whispered. I am coming up the stairs. I am on the first step. Now I am on the second step. Emily got scared and called her parents. But they didn't hear her. And they didn't come. Then the voice whispered, Emily, I'm on the top step. Now I'm in the hall. Now I'm outside your room. Then it whispered, I'm standing right next to your bed. And then, I've got you! Emily screamed, and the voice stopped. Her father rushed into the room and turned on the light. Somebody is in here, Emily said. They looked and looked. Nobody was there. I remember when I first heard the story of the 39 steps and the blue room. A man had built this mansion for his bride. And up on the third floor, he built this marvelous blue room. And leading to it, starting on the second floor, were 39 steps up to the blue room. And then you had to step over a high threshold. And there inside was this magnificent blue room. Everything was blue. The ceiling, the walls, the floor, the bedding. There was a fireplace in the blue room. He had even painted some of the wood blue. He was going to live in the blue room for a couple of nights before they got married. The first night that he went to the blue room, he lit a fire in the fireplace. And he sat down and began to enjoy the fire. The next day, they found his body down at the bottom of the 39 steps. He had broken his neck. He was dead. There were other people who came and tried to live for one night in the blue room. And each morning, they found that same person down the bottom of the 39 steps with a broken neck. I thought, maybe I can find out what went wrong. I thought maybe I could find out what the mystery to the Blue Room was. And so I got permission to spend a night in the Blue Room. I walked up the 39 steps, and I stepped over the high threshold, went into the room and shut the door. It was a beautiful room. And I put some wood in the fireplace and lit a fire. And I had brought a book with me, and I sat down in a chair near the fireplace and began to read a book. And I don't know what it was, but I fell asleep. When I woke up, the room was full of smoke, and I tried to get out. I couldn't breathe, and so I ran toward the door. I opened the door, and I started to rush out. Just as I rushed out, I remembered in my head the high threshold. And even though I tripped over it a little, I grabbed a hold of it as I started down, so that I slid down the steps instead of falling head over heels. I ended up scratched, and it hurt quite a bit, but I had found out the mystery of the Blue Room. It was the high threshold. Somehow, in the building of the Blue Room, the chimney to the fireplace had got stuffed up. And the smoke, instead of going out, would come back in and fill up the room. And whoever was there would try to get out, but as they got out, they would forget about the high threshold. And they would trip over it and go down the 39 steps. I was just lucky. The others were dead. Sue always went to the 7 o'clock Sunday morning service at her church. Usually she heard the clanging of the church bells while she was eating breakfast. But this morning, she heard them while she was still in bed. That means I'm late, she thought. Sue jumped out of bed, quickly dressed, and left without eating or looking at the clock. It was still dark outside, but it usually was dark at this time of year. Sue was the only one on the street. The only sound she heard were the clatter of her shoes on the pavement. Everybody must already be in church, she thought. Sue took a shortcut through the cemetery. Then she quietly slipped into the church and found a seat. The service had already begun. When she caught her breath, Sue looked around. The church was filled with people she had never seen before. But the woman next to her did look familiar. Sue smiled at her. It's Jillian Ferris, she thought. But she's dead. She died a month ago. Suddenly, Sue felt uneasy. She looked around again. As her eyes began to adjust to the dim light, Sue saw some skeletons in suits and dresses. This is a service for the dead, Sue thought. Everybody here is dead except me. Sue noticed that some of them were staring at her. They looked angry, as if she had no business there. Jillian Ferris leaned toward her and whispered, "Leave right after the benediction if you care for your life." When the service came to an end, the minister gave his blessing. "The Lord bless you and keep you," he said. "The Lord make his face to shine upon you." Sue grabbed her coat and walked quickly toward the door. When she heard footsteps behind her, she glanced back. Several of the dead were coming toward her. Others were getting up to join them. "The Lord lift up his countenance to you," the minister went on. Sue was so frightened, she began to run. Out the door she ran, with a pack of shrieking ghosts at her heels. "Get out!" one of them screamed. Another shouted, "You don't belong here!" and ripped her coat away. As Sue ran through the cemetery, a third grabbed the hat from her head. "Don't come back!" it screamed and shook its arm at her. By the time Sue reached the street, the sun was rising and the dead had disappeared. "Did this really happen?" Sue asked herself. "Or have I been dreaming?" That afternoon, one of Sue's friends brought over her coat and hat, or what was left of them. They had been found in the cemetery, torn to shreds. The worms crawl in, the worms crawl out, the worms play pinochle on your snout. Let's begin at the beginning. Don't you ever laugh as the hearse goes by, for you may be the next to die. They wrap you up in a big white sheet from your head down to your feet. They put you in a big black box and cover you up with dirt and rocks. All goes well for about a week. Then your coffin begins to leak. The worms crawl in, the worms crawl out. The worms play pinochle on your snout. They eat your eyes, they eat your nose. They eat the jelly between your toes. A big green worm with rolling eyes crawls in your stomach and out your eyes. Your stomach turns a slimy green, and pus pours out like whipping cream. You spread it on a slice of bread, and that's what you eat when you are dead. Here we are back in the graveyard. It's time for us to leave now. I hope that you have been entertained. I must go now and find other places to haunt.